Paragon CPD. Today's topic is the diagnosis and monitoring of hypothyroidism. I'm Ben Safrani. I'm a resident in internal medicine. I'm joined today by Lizzie Conway, our specialist in internal medicine. Hi.
Hi.
So let's get started. What is hypothyroidism, Lizzie?
Well, hypothyroidism is kind of what the name says on the tin. It is an underproduction of thyroid hormone. Now, in dogs, the majority of hypothyroidism is due to what we call primary hypothyroidism, which is a failure of the thyroid gland itself. In people, there is also well-recognized secondary hypothyroidism, where the issue is with the pituitary production of thyroid-stimulating hormone, the hormone that normally tells the thyroid to make its thyroid hormone. And there's also tertiary hypothyroidism, where one more step up the chain, the hypothalamus doesn't produce thyrotrophin-releasing hormone, or TRH, and that in turn fails to stimulate the thyroid to produce thyroid hormone. But both secondary and tertiary hypothyroidism are incredibly rare in dogs, and pretty much all cases of hypothyroidism in dogs are due to primary hypothyroidism due to dysfunction of the thyroid gland itself. And histologically, there are two types of change that we see affecting the gland. You can see a lymphocytic inflammation, which seems to be immune mediated, and you can also see idiopathic atrophy of the thyroid gland. Now, although I've kind of said those are two separate conditions, there is actually some evidence that the atrophy may just be the end stage of the immune mediated lymphocytic thyroiditis. But there is still quite a lot of debate in the endocrine world as to whether this is always the case, or we also have some idiopathic atrophies for unknown reasons. Either way, hypothyroidism is very important to know about because it's probably the commonest endocrinopathy we see in canine patients, with some breeds such as Golden Retrievers and Dobermans being really predisposed to it.
That's great. And what clinical signs would make us suspicious that an animal is hypothyroid?
Yeah, so the thyroid hormone has a wide range of effects within the body. It's a hormone that exerts effect within the nucleus of cells. So it causes this transcription of a whole load of different genes. But broadly speaking, the clinical signs, kind of the main role of thyroid hormone within the body, is to kind of increase metabolic rate. So when we are deficient in thyroid hormone, the clinical signs we see are associated with a low metabolic rate. The clinical signs are quite subtle initially. They come on quite gradually. We tend to see them in middle-age to older dogs. Hypothyroidism isn't a disease of young animals at all. And what we see is we see things like lethargy, we see inactivity. Often these dogs will be poorly tolerant of being in cold environments. We do often see weight gain. Now, it's important to note that this is weight gain despite no increase in appetite. I think polyphagic animals, yeah, we all know about Cushing's disease, where our animals will be polyphagic and often getting these big pot bellies. Hypothyroidism, it's really important to note that actually these animals don't have a change in diet. The other really common set of clinical signs we see in our hypothyroid animals are the dermatologic signs. About 60 to 80% of dogs with hypothyroidism will have skin changes. Those skin changes are a non-pruritic alopecia. And the reason for this is that the hairs enter the telogen phase earlier than they would normally do. And so they're much more easily shed than normal. So actually, in the first instance, the hair loss that we see is at the areas of excessive wear or pressure. So it's, you know, under the dog's collar or its harness and at the base of the tail. We think about these classic rat tails that our hypothyroid dogs have. Hair quality can also be reduced. Lots of owners will just say their dog's hair coat looks a bit rubbish. A lot of them will get hyperpigmentation, so areas of black skin and comedones as well. And although in the early stages, the dermatological change with hypothyroidism is non-pruritic, if they get secondary infections, it can go on to become pruritic or pustular. So that's worth bearing in mind. Rarer clinical signs that we can see with hypothyroidism. Now, Some dogs with hypothyroidism will get neuropathies, so generalized nerve dysfunction. There's some associations between hypothyroidism and vestibular episodes, and some associations with trigeminal neuropathies as well. But they're quite rare, and certainly not the majority of dogs with hypothyroidism will have those changes. From a cardiovascular point of view, hypothyroidism does cause some subtle changes to cardiac function. So an animal with hypothyroidism, I wouldn't expect it to be a primary cause of cardiac disease. But I mentioned before, Dobermans are predisposed to hypothyroidism. A lot of Dobermans also have DCM, as we all know. And being hypothyroid at the same time as having DCM can sort of worsen their systolic function. There can be some ECG abnormalities, such as first degree AV blocks. Finally, other things you might see, some dogs the first time will pick up that they're hypothyroid is that they get changes within the eye. So a lot of hypothyroid dogs, probably about 75% of them, will have high cholesterol or hypertriglyceridemia on their blood test results. And as a consequence of that, these dogs can develop corneal lipidosis, so white opacities within the cornea that are actually due to fat deposition. So yes, there's a wide range of clinical signs, but I think the most important thing to bear in mind is that hypothyroidism, although a lot of these clinical signs can overlap with the signs of Cushing's, hypothyroidism does not cause PUPD, it does not cause polyphagia, and crucially, hypothyroid dogs aren't usually unwell in themselves at the point of diagnosis. If we did blood work on these dogs, as I said, a lot of them will have hypercholesterolemia, and around about 30% will have a mild normocytic, normochronic, non-regenerative anemia. Occasionally, we also wonder if a dog might be hypothyroid due to liver enzyme elevations we've picked up on bloods, but they're usually a very, very mild increase in ALT or ALKP at best. So yeah, that's the kind of broad spectrum of things we might see in a hypothyroid patient.
That's really interesting, thank you. So if we had a case with these classical clinical signs, how would we go about diagnosing hypothyroidism, making that diagnosis? Is the disease just what it says on the tin? Is it just a case of demonstrating low thyroid hormone?
Well, yes and no. So the first thing to consider when we think about measuring thyroid hormone is that it actually has several different forms within the body. The major form of thyroid hormone that the thyroid produces is T4, but it also produces very, very small amounts, kind of less than 1% of its production is T3, which is much more biologically active than T4. So first thing, we want to measure T4. But actually, T4 itself circulates in the blood in two forms. 99% of thyroid hormone circulates bound to one of a variety of different plasma proteins, while around about 1% of it circulates in its unbound form, which we call free T4. So when we measure T4, we're actually measuring total T4, the sum of the bound and the free forms. And as I said, although it's technically possible to measure T3 levels, which, as I say, is released in really, really small amounts from the thyroid. And T3 technically is the active form of T4. So what happens when T4 reaches the cell is that it's metabolized into T3, and it's T3 that goes and acts on the cell. But actually, measuring T3 has been found to be really unhelpful for measuring hypothyroidism. The majority of animals have got normal, teeny tiny T3 levels, even if they are hypothyroid. So first thing to say, we measure total T4. But it's not, sadly, as simple as just measuring total T4, because actually there is an awful lot of overlap between the total T4 levels in normal healthy dogs and in truly hypothyroid dogs. We also have the problem that lots of other things can affect T4 levels in a normal animal as well. So sick animals, they will have a reduced total T4 levels. We call this the sick euthyroid syndrome. And we think this is a physiological response to illness, where during times of ill health, the body lowers the metabolic rate to conserve energy so it can kind of focus on fighting whatever illness is going on. As well as illness, there are certain medications our patients might be on, in particular steroids, the anti-epileptic phenobarbitone, and the sulfonamide-based antibiotics, which are well known that they can reduce T4 levels as well. Just to add to the problem, in terms of interpreting total T4 levels, we are increasingly recognising that different breeds of dog have different normal ranges for thyroid hormone levels. I think the most well-known example is greyhounds and the other sighthound breeds, who normally have a lower T4 reference range compared to other breeds. So overall, though, yes, if you measure T4 alone, you can exclude hypothyroidism if you get a mid to high normal result. Knowing that hypothyroid dogs really, really rarely have a T4 level over about 1.5 grams per deciliter. Once you get below that level, your dog could be hypothyroid. It could be a completely normal dog. So unfortunately, we can't use total T4 alone for a positive diagnosis of hypothyroidism.
And what's the best combination of tests to make a confident diagnosis?
So I think, unfortunately, there is no perfect test for hypothyroidism. There are lots of different tests available to us. I think, as we said before, when we were talking about clinical signs, before you dive into screening thyroid function, does the dog have convincing clinical signs of hypothyroidism? As with all laboratory tests, we can improve the diagnostic performance of our tests by only performing them on dogs who we truly believe we have the disease before we start testing them. So do your clinical signs fit? Does your routine biochemistry fit? In particular, it'd be really unlikely for a dog to be hypothyroid without some degree of hyperlipidemia on bloods. So that's seen in 75 to 80% of them. In an ideal world, similar to what we do with Cushing's disease, we would use a stimulation test to test thyroid function, giving either TSH or TRH to the animal and measuring how much T4 does the thyroid produce in response to that. Now, although the TSH stimulation test has been used historically, and there's lots of research showing it can be really useful in differentiating hypothyroidism from things like sick euthyroid syndrome, unfortunately, TSH itself hasn't been available in the UK for years and years and years, although it is available in some countries in Europe. So this isn't something we can do clinically. Equally, you can test the function of the thyroid by looking at its ability to take up iodine using scintigraphy. So if you read the textbooks, you might see this classed as one of our gold standard tests for thyroid function, but it's not straightforward, it's not easily available, and you end up with the slight issue of having a radioactive dog for a few days afterwards. So it's not, again, it's not really a practical way of looking for hypothyroidism. So back in the real world, what we're left with is measuring basal hormone levels. So the most useful combination of all the different bits of the thyroid axis that we can measure is a combination of the total T4 level plus the TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone level. With the logic that if an animal is truly hypothyroid, as in the thyroid has failed, it's not responding to stimulation from the pituitary anymore, that animal will have a low total T4 level, but a really high TSH level. And the logic behind that is that the hypothalamic pituitary axis is recognizing the low T4 level in the body. It's not getting any negative feedback in response to T4. And so it releases more and more TSH from the pituitary to try and stimulate the thyroid to produce more thyroid hormone. The other scenario, when you have a sick euthyroid animal who might have given you a low total T4 level, in those animals, their T4 is reduced as a physiological mechanism, as we said, to cope with illness. So actually, they'll have a low TSH. You know, they've got a low stimulus to the thyroid to produce the hormone. And the low thyroid level is a centrally driven response. There are, however, as with everything in endocrinology, some limitations to using T4 and TSH. For example, although when the animal is sick with a severe illness, you would expect the T4 and TSH to both be low. when they're recovering from that non-thyroidal illness, their TSH will start to increase first, followed later by their T4 as they kind of, you know, get back to normal again. So at a certain stage in recovery from their illness, we can see a picture of low total T4, high TSH, which is can mimic hypothyroidism. So just as we stress the importance of not testing for hypothyroidism in animals who are very, very unwell, it's equally important to ensure that we're patient and we wait at least a couple of weeks after they're recovered before we revisit the idea of thyroid testing.
Okay, you've made that all sound suspiciously simple. We're seeing an increase of labs offering thyroid panels that include other things like free T4, antithyroglobulin antibodies, and an advanced thyroid panel that includes antithyroid antibodies. When's that something that's useful to request?
Okay, so that's a really good question. Starting with free T4, that can sometimes help us to differentiate between dogs that are truly hypothyroid and those with non-thyroidal illness. Doesn't always, but a lot of the time what you'll see is that an animal with a very, very mild non-thyroidal illness will still maintain a normal free T4 level, whereas a truly hypothyroid dog will have both a low total T4 level and free T4 level. It's important, however, to note that severe non-thyroidal illness will also start to depress the free T4 levels to exactly the same level as what hypothyroidism will do. So it can sometimes be helpful in that situation, but equally it can sometimes muddy the waters a lot more. And I often find that the best option is to wait and retest just the total T4 and TSH 6 to 8 weeks after the animal is back to full health again, if at that point I'm still clinically suspicious that the animal might be hypothyroid.
And how about those antibodies that we mentioned?
Well, okay, so the antithyroglobulin antibodies, those are antibodies that the body forms against the protein thyroglobulin. Now, thyroglobulin is the protein that binds and stores the thyroid hormone within the thyroid follicles in the thyroid gland. And studies have shown that these antibodies are produced during the inflammatory stage of lymphocytic thyroiditis. And about 50%, if you look at the literature, of dogs who have hypothyroidism will have increased levels of thyroglobulin autoantibodies. So if you are convinced that a dog is hypothyroid, but your T4 and TSH are inconclusive, you may be in the situation where your dog has got early hypothyroidism, and you could consider testing to see has the dog got antithyroglobulin antibodies. Because again, some animals who've got early lymphocytic thyroiditis, they might not quite be that functionally hypothyroid yet, but about 50% of them will have those antibodies there. So sometimes it can help you reach a diagnosis a bit earlier than you might do if you're having to wait and retest further down the line.
Okay, that makes sense. And then what about the antithyroid antibodies? Are they the same thing?
No, so antithyroid antibodies are slightly different. Those are antibodies against T4 and T3 themselves. They're not on our standard, as you said before, our standard thyroid panels. Not all labs offer them, but on some of the advanced thyroid testing panels, you will see them mentioned. Antibodies against T4 and T3, they can be present in dogs with hypothyroidism, but actually only in about 2 to 15% of them. So they're not really that useful a diagnostic aid. If I'm struggling to make a diagnosis of hypothyroidism, they seldom help. They are important to know about, however, from a testing point of view, because they can interfere with some of the thyroid hormone tests available. With the majority of assays that the lab use currently, they are based on, you know, the test itself works on the basis of measuring levels of binding of free thyroid hormone to antibody in the test. And if your dog has got these antithyroid antibodies circulating, that's going to bind to some of the free T4 and basically mess up the test result. And in the majority of tests, it artificially increases the T4 level. So it could theoretically give you a false normal T4 in a dog who is truly hypothyroid. Having said that, if you've done your combination of your T4 and your TSH, you would still usually expect to see a high TSH in that situation.
Perfect. So to summarise what you've explained really clearly, the key to diagnosis of hypothyroidism is really making sure the clinical signs fit before we start testing. And that usually we see this combination of low total T4 and high TSH with or without the presence of thyroglobulin autoantibodies. That's what we're looking for to make a confident diagnosis.
Yeah, pretty much. So that's what we're going to do for diagnosis. Obviously, treatment of hypothyroidism, I've always thought it's reasonably simple. We start them on thyroid supplementation with levothyroxine. But how do we monitor these patients? How do we decide if this treatment is adequate or not?
So I often think that there are two parts to monitoring these patients. Firstly, the clinical response that we see, and then the clinico-pathological response. I think as vets, it's really easy to become focused on the second part and the numbers and aiming to get our values into the perfect range that the lab give us. However, I think both parts are equally important. It's really important not to overlook that first part. I think if anything, the clinical improvement is more important for the owners in terms of their satisfaction with our treatment and the quality of life for our patients. So I find right at the beginning, at the offset of treatment, it's helpful to give owners an idea of what to expect and when to expect to see it in terms of clinical improvement. And this can help both with managing their expectations, but also flagging if the response to treatment isn't what we'd expect and if we possibly need to look for a problem. So we normally expect a fairly rapid improvement in things like mentation and activity levels. So normally within the first week of treatment, we'd expect owners to see a benefit. Things like the dermatological, cardiological, neurological changes can all take a bit longer. So it can take 2 to 4 months to see an improvement with those things.
Yeah. And when we are using blood tests to help us with our monitoring, which ones should we use? Is it just a case of getting the total T4 within the normal range, or should we be monitoring any of those other things that I talked about before?
It's not a straightforward answer to what would seem like a simple question. Total T4, I think, is the minimum we should be monitoring in terms of the thyroid-specific blood testing. And in some cases, it can be sufficient just to keep an eye on this, I think, especially in cases where owners might be money limited. We can just look at T4, and we normally want that to fall in the upper half of the normal range, or even slightly above if we're measuring that at the peak time. In some cases, it can be useful to add TSH and give a better overview of the effectiveness of treatment. What we hope to see is that with feedback inhibition, we'd expect that to drop back into the normal range if treatment's adequate. I think that knowing what TSH is up to is particularly useful in cases where we're unsure if a dose change is needed. So, for example, a case where the peak T4 is right in the middle of the reference range, we're not sure if we should push the dose of levothyroxine up a little bit. I think in this instance, if the TSH is normal, then we're probably doing an okay job of supplementing. We probably don't need to go any higher. However, if that T4 is kind of total T4 is kind of middling and TSH is still high, we're probably underdosing. It's worth mentioning that TSH is only really useful in those patients where it is clearly high at the time of diagnosis. And it can also take a bit longer for TSH to respond. So if we're looking at it a bit earlier in the time of treatment, it might be that we just need to give it a little bit longer to allow it to drop back down again. In terms of free T4, the other things that you've mentioned, there wouldn't be anything wrong with measuring free T4 in these cases. It's physiologically an appropriate thing to do. But generally for measuring free T4, especially by things like equilibrium dialysis, it's a much more expensive test to do than total T4. And in most patients, it doesn't really add anything. So it's just not worth doing. The exception are patients where those patients you mentioned earlier, where they have antithyroid antibodies that might interfere with total T4 measurement, free T4 might be a bit more useful in those guys. And finally, in terms of monitoring blood work, I think it's always worth checking the hematology and biochemistry, particularly if they were very abnormal at the time of diagnosis, making sure that those abnormalities disappear. And that normally happens in the first few weeks of treatment. It's not something we necessarily need to do long term if things are going well. So for sort of further monitoring down the line, it might be okay just to look at more simple things.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you would look at your peak T4 level. What are the recommended timings of these blood samples?
In terms of, first of all, timing, in terms of when in the course of treatment, we normally do our first monitoring blood test after about 6 to 8 weeks of starting treatment with either thyroxine. And by this stage, if our diagnosis was correct and we're on an appropriate dose, we'd expect owners to be quite happy with how things are going. And by that, we'd expect them to see a clear improvement in their pets in terms of demeanour and mentation. And then we normally recheck that, so about 2 to 4 weeks after a change of dose, so to check that we've got that right. Once we're confident that sort of these patients are adequately supplemented and ticking along nicely, we normally just monitor every 3 months or 6 months or even longer is often fine. In terms of timing of the sampling in the day, we normally aim to assess the peak serum level. We think that normally occurs between 4 and 6 hours after sampling. So it's something that just is worth taking a bit of planning when we're booking that appointment in our day, of knowing when the owner's giving the medication and when we can do it. We normally aim for that to be 4 or 6 hours later. There's some textbooks, a lot of textbooks talk about measuring a trough level, even recommend measuring a trough level as well. So measure taking a sample just before giving the dose and then doing the 4 to 6 hours later. But although that gives a really nice complete picture of what's happening, it's not normally necessary apart from in some very specific circumstances.
Yeah. And what if, based on kind of clinical signs, bloods, what if the treatment's not working? What things would you do in those situations?
Yeah, so there are a few different ways where things could not be working. That could be problems with blood results that we're getting. It could be problems with what the owners are reporting. And of course, we'd hope to have a clinically improved dog with perfect bloods. And yeah, we'll talk through the different scenarios where that isn't the case. I can think of sort of three scenarios. One would be where we have no clinical improvement and the bloods are still abnormal. So everything's looking a bit disappointing at that point. And the simplest explanation for this is just that we're not giving enough levothyroxine. And if that's the case, it might be worth just double checking the dose, checking that we are at the recommended dose for the patient's weight. It's also worth checking that the patient's been treated long enough as well, that this isn't a recheck that's been booked just a bit early in the day. In the first instance, if this was a dog that was on a lowish dose and it was relatively early in the course of treatment, I think it's reasonable just to increase the dose of levothyroxine by 20-25% and then checking again after a few more weeks. Failing that, so if we're a bit further down the line and we're pretty happy with the dose, I'd then look at, have we chosen to treat this patient once daily or twice daily? So if it's only being treated once daily, it might just be that the levothyroxine is too short acting. We need to go to twice daily. And often if that was the case, we'd find that our peak total T4 was okay, but TSH would be sort of creeping up on us a little bit and still have some clinical signs. If we really wanted to prove this was what was happening, this is one of those instances where measuring a trough level might be an okay thing to do. To prove that the once daily isn't adequate, although there's a query whether that's something we ever really need to prove or whether if we find ourselves in this instance just trying going to twice daily and seeing if that fixes things is the better way of going, but either's fine. Occasionally we'll find a patient where they're definitely on what we'd consider quite a substantial dose, clinical signs are persisting and the bloods are still abnormal. This is quite an unusual situation to find ourselves in. That's when maybe we want to take a step back and chat to the owners, maybe have a conversation with the owners about compliance, about who's administering the medication, if they're having any issues. Even sort of checking things about whether it's an appropriate amount of time that they're coming back for refills to make sure that they are giving the right dose, and just checking that I've communicated the dose effectively to them. If this is all definitely okay, I think we can then start thinking about, could there be an absorption issue, and questioning, are there any gastrointestinal signs? Do we need to be measuring things like a folate and a cobalamin in case there's an enterophthalmy grumbling around in the background and interfering with the medication absorption? So I think that kind of covers the first scenario. I think the second situation we might find ourselves in is a dog that's actually doing a bit better, but the buds aren't where we want them to be. I suppose that's a better position to be in. I suppose we don't want to be in that position where we're treating the bloods rather than the patient, but I think it is still worth having a look at things in that case. So we might find that we've got both a low total T4 and a low TSH. And if that was to be the case, I'd start wondering about are there any other medications that have been prescribed that could be interfering with things? Have they had any steroids, either systemic or topical? That could be interfering with thyroid hormone measurement. It might be worth just sort of going back and taking a more detailed history and just seeing, could there be a new non-thyroidal illness that's snuck in since the last monitoring? And then the other instance we might find ourselves in, which is a bit trickier, is if thyroid hormone is actually normal, so if it's in that target range, that upper half or even just above the normal range, but the TSH is high, or even if T4 is a little bit low, the TSH is still high, but we've got a happy patient. And that's where, again, we don't feel like we've been focused on the blood results and ignoring our patients. However, I think I'd argue that if the T4 is below the target level at peak, it might be that we're making things a little bit better than they were before, but we're not really fully treating the dog, and it might be that the owners can appreciate further improvement by pushing things up higher. In terms of the seeing a persistent TSH elevation, if this is early in the course of treatment, if everything else is okay, it might be worth just giving it a bit longer and checking again after a few weeks, remembering that TSH can take a little bit longer to normalise than T4. However, if that's persistent, again, it becomes a bit tricky in that instance in terms of, do we just leave things alone or do we try and change things and try and normalise that? And there's not lots of evidence about what the right thing to do in this instance is. There is sort of a relatively old study now of beagles who were hypothyroid and were left untreated and followed for years to see what happened to them. And this study found that these beagles had a much higher rate of thyroid neoplasia than would be expected normally. It's kind of led to a theory that maybe this excess TSH might be one of the things that drives tumorigenesis. And this isn't strong evidence. It's not particularly sort of clinical evidence that we can use in all of our patients. But knowing this sometimes would be just the push that I would need to increase the dose in patients with normal T4 and high TSH. And the final situation would be one where the dog's not doing very well, but the bloods are okay, so T4 and TSH are where we'd expect them to be, but the owners are still sort of complaining about the dogs not being well. And this is a situation that would probably make me want to take a big step back and re-examine that initial diagnosis and just checking that we did follow your good advice about how to diagnose our patients reliably. It's also maybe worth being clear about what exactly the owners mean by lack of clinical improvement, and going back to one of my earlier points of, if they're worried that the dog's hair hasn't grown back and we're only sort of 6 weeks into treatment, then that's kind of expected. And if actually with a bit more probing we find the dog isn't lethargic, it's losing weight, it might be fine just to wait a couple more months and just tell them to kind of hang on, and that it might be a little bit longer before they see the changes that they're looking for. But yeah, I think if they truly aren't seeing an improvement, then it made me wonder if we did have our correct diagnosis to begin with, and if there could be something else that was throwing that initial diagnosis out.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And I guess the final question I've got is, if we've got a dog who clinically, we know it's hypothyroid, it's not doing well, do I have to do all this testing? Can I just keep putting the thyroxine supplementation dose upwards? Is it possible to overdose a dog with thyroid supplementation?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So over-supplementation with levothyroxine causing hypothyroid or thyrotoxicosis that we cause it is possible. But it's actually pretty rare. There's a few reasons for why, but it's definitely something that can happen. The reasons it's quite difficult to do this is that levothyroxine has quite short half-life, and there are several protective mechanisms that kick in when feedback mechanisms in the body start detecting that the thyroid hormones T4 levels are higher than they should be. And that includes the absorption from the gastrointestinal tract getting drops and increased clearance from the liver and kidneys. There are some patients that might be at higher risk of this, so patients with reduced hepatic and renal function might be at an increased risk. They're not able to use these backup mechanisms as well. So larger patients like the Great Danes and Mastiff type breeds might be at higher risk, especially if levothyroxine is dosed on a milligram per kilo basis. In most of the recommendations you'll find in books and formularies for dosing, there's a mg per kg and a mg per meter squared dose, and tend to try and use the mg per meter squared dose for large dogs, certainly dogs over 25 kilos. In those cases where thyrotoxicosis does develop, the clinical signs tend to be sorts of things we think about in hypothyroid cats, so with a few extra bits. So panting can be quite a common sign in dogs that people report. Things like nervousness, anxiety, tachycardia, polyuria and polydipsia, polyphagia, and weight loss despite this. And cardiac arrhythmias have been, there are a few reports of cardiac arrhythmias. Normally, this is in cases with underlying cardiac disease. And the problem with thyrotoxicosis is it has been reported in some dogs that actually have a total T4 level within the reference range. But in some cases, seems to tolerate having elevated total T4 without any signs of thyrotoxicosis. So it is a bit hard to know when we should really be worried about it in terms of having a cutoff in terms of total T4 level. But I think it's something, although it's really rare, it might be something that we never come across in our career even. It's worth just knowing about it so that if we have an owner coming back and actually describing any of these signs to the dog that's on levothyroxine, that is something that's worth having in mind. And the simplest way of finding out if this is truly thyrotoxicosis or something different is that the good thing about it is that the signs normally resolve quite quickly when treatment's withdrawn. So if you have a case where you think that might be going on within sort of a maximum of 3 days of stopping treatment, we would expect to, if we assess the response at that point, to see an improvement in the signs that are worrying the owners. If we do have a case, if that did happen, the things I'd think about would be just double checking that the dose is right, again, double checking the owner compliance, that there's not two owners sort of double medicating the dog by mistake. Again, checking the initial diagnosis was the right one, and we're not accidentally supplementing a dog who's got a functioning thyroid gland. It might be worth checking liver and kidney function to see if there's a reason that they're struggling to cope with the dose. And then if we are happy that the thyroid supplementation is right, so restarting after a little break, but it's a bit of a lower dose.
Cool, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I think that's probably just about everything we could possibly discuss about the diagnosis and monitoring of hypothyroidism. I hope that has been useful for everyone listening, and thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.